Okay, fine. Yeah, well, hello everyone. It's nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Fran. So I'm Rachel Carmenter. And as I was saying previously, I was at UCCRI in a sort of interdisciplinary cross-departmental project. And since July last year, I've been with the University of East Anglia, which has been a sort of nice full circle in a way, because that's also where I did my degree, which was in ecology. But then through my PhD, I became to become far more interdisciplinary, which is also ironic, really, because I'd chosen ecology specifically so as not to have to deal with anything too heavily philosophical or difficult, such as people and justice or rights or anything like that. But then through my work with C4, I think, you know, the reality that actually systems and people are just so connected was inescapable. And so my PhD was looking at fire in the Brazilian Amazon, using different scales and methods of analysis to understand fire management and frequency. But what I wanted to talk to you about today is some thoughts which are also in a paper now. So I began to think about this idea of smallholders, small-scale farmers in the tropics, being really between a rock and a hard place. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that in this set of few slides which I've got. But like I said, you know, this is nothing really exhaustive and just some slides for talking points, really. It's more of an informal discussion. So these are some of the areas where I work, or I would say my main themes of research. And I think fire is cross-cutting across them. So often the entry point to the design and social equity of environmental governance for me has been through the context of tropical fire, and especially in the Brazilian Amazon and Indonesian's peatlands. So environmental governance, but then of course that connects to political ecology and agrarian and environmental change. And now I suppose through links at the Tyndall Center, thinking more specifically about climate change. And then again, you know, working in the tropics and with fire and with smallholders, this conservation, and also my roots were in ecology. So there's environmental justice and biocultural approaches sort of feature in what I do, I think, and increasingly thinking about how the environment and well-being, human well-being, are linked. And again, fire in that context, because of course fire is creating many different harms on well-being, which I don't think are really staged in the discourse and narrative and a lot of the science on fire, tropical fire. So I'll talk about that a bit more later. And as you all know, tropical forests are home to many, many rural, small-scale households. They are home sites of production, agricultural production, and also different levels of extraction of forest goods and resources. They are places where knowledge is embedded and has taken, you know, over generations, valuable, rich amount of diverse knowledge and diverse cultures and life ways. And of course, biodiversity itself is a hotspot. The hotspots of biodiversity are in the tropics. So these are the landscapes which I'm talking about, and specifically about shifting cultivation, I guess, in those landscapes, which I'm sure that you're all familiar with. But of course, shifting cultivation is a long-standing agricultural practice. And whilst it's decreasing, it is still found all across the tropics. And it's often small scale, it's low input, and lots of the food produced in these systems is for consumption rather than sale. So it's often subsistence systems. They're very diverse systems, organic, but fire is also a part of this system. And so I often think about how, you know, coming into this work, this focus on fire, which has been over a decade now, I was sort of thinking as far as a problem that needed to be resolved. And that was really, I think for me, a sort of implicit part of my PhD was going to Brazil and thinking about how to help solve the fire problem, because then I would never really say shifting cultivation. We always talked about slash and burn, which obviously has a kind of derogatory sound to it. And I wouldn't use that term anymore, because I think the context in which shifting cultivation is used has changed around smallholders. And of course, smallholders or traditional farmers have been burning for generations without the sorts of landscape flammability that we see today. But today we do see huge flammability in different biomes. And whilst people suggest we should be calling this now the Anthropocene, others also say it's equally the Pyrocene. Fire is featuring much more heavily in our systems, and the likelihood is that's going to continue to increase. And this is, you know, fire as a, if we think about the narrative of fire or the discourse, it's really large scale and it's nefarious. So including the fact that once fire-free biomes such as tropics are now fire-prone. And so there are these new dynamics, new climatic dynamics, ecological dynamics, landscape dynamics, and stakeholders involved in these landscapes that are creating this flammability. And the prognosis is that fire weather is, you know, continuing to increase as climate change. Fire is also going to, as the climate continues to change, fires are also likely to become more extensive and more frequent. And they have the real possibility of extenuating the vulnerabilities of these small-scale farmers and the world's poor. But of course, those farmers also use fire. They're dependent on fire and have been for generations, and equally are on the front line when fires escape into the landscape. And I guess stepping back just slightly from is to say, you know, to me, the fires then are quite emblematic of the tension, broader tensions between environment and development. And they've proven an intractable governance challenge. So if we think about, I mean, I am skipping a little bit here between Brazil and Indonesia, so later we can clarify anything that might be confusing because of that. But, you know, they're dynamic and in contested, these dynamic and contested frontiers, and fires have proven an intractable governance challenge. So especially, I think, in, for instance, Indonesia's peatlands, but also in the Brazilian Amazon, they haven't been easy to resolve. And different governance solutions have proven to fail. You know, they've had many different shortfalls and haven't delivered fire-free outcomes. And I think things are particularly chronic in the peatlands in Indonesia, where there's the oil palm sort of dimension to peatland conversion. So they're a leading then humanitarian and also environmental and climatic issue, and obviously have vastly different streams of benefits and burdens accruing to different stakeholders. So really quite a complex phenomena. And I think, as I said earlier, you know, there is this concept when we hear about mega fires on the news, or even reading much of the work on fires, which often is dominantly from the natural sciences, there is this sort of danger of all fire being conflated as one, a single nefarious fire, if you like, when actually we know from different work, and especially, I suppose, interdisciplinary work or work that engages social sciences at all and human dimensions, that there are very different types of fire and stakeholders using fire and scales of fire, incentives for fire use, and within that, different capacities to manage fire any differently. So, for instance, in the Brazilian Amazon, a paper that Joss Barlow and colleagues we developed sort of thought about a typology of fire in the Brazilian Amazon, and I haven't actually changed the language here, sorry for that, but deforestation fires are one particular type, and of course they contribute to forest fires or fires that extend outside of the intended area. Then there's fires for pasture management, by the cattle ranchers, again at different scales, and they too can escape into the surrounding forests. And then there are the, and here it does say slash and burn, but the Sweden agricultural fires, which of course also play a role in fire escape. And I think it would be really interesting actually to try to understand what contribution all of these different fire types make to the uncontrolled or extensive forest fires. Because one way of thinking about these is those which are intentional and those which are accidental, or fires that spread beyond their boundaries. But really the key thing is that different stakeholders with different sets of capacity and access to resources to respond to policy or to respond to adaptive measures for fire management vary between these different stakeholders. And again, in Indonesia's peatlands, we did some work, David Gaveau and others and I, to show that fires on the peatlands are often, or at least, you know, to some extent occurring in different types of land tenure type. So associated again with different types of stakeholders, including small and medium sized oil palm enterprises, and then local or micro small scale production of oil palm. And within all of this, there's an intense blame game, of course, finger pointing and sort of defining actually the culpability of fire is quite problematic too, because of the attributes of fire itself and its ability to move across the landscape and invade an area that maybe that area was intentional from the first instance. Anyway, the culpability is very difficult to determine, also because land tenure is often extremely opaque in these contexts. But so in the paper then, which that was all kind of background really, but in this paper, which is called Between a Rock and a Hard Place, we look at the reality of landscape flammability for smallholder farmers in three different geographies, in the Madagascan highlands and in the Philippines and in the Brazilian Amazon. And we basically, the main sort of point is that we show this recurrent situation in which small scale farmers are both reliant on fire for their production and their food security, but also on the front line as landscapes become more flammable through fragmentation, through climate changes, through different stakeholders using fire with different sorts of incentives and visions of what the landscape should be, you know, different types of development aspiration. So there's pressure and risk associated with using fire, but also no alternative actually, and especially, you know, particularly in the Amazon, where whilst there are alternatives, they're certainly not being rolled out and accessibility is an issue. So fire in agriculture is a central tenet still, and it looks like it will be that way for some time. But then small scale farmers, because of the blaming and the different sets of or lines of power and dynamics amongst the stakeholders, are often also blamed for fire escape. Because, you know, there's a narrative that agriculture, which is traditional like that, is backwards and it needs development, and that it's the small scale farmers who are causing the problem. And so there's a sense of increasing illegality, which itself can create more fire risk because it changes the way in which people communicate about fire and how they manage fire, encourages setting fires, but then leaving them because people don't want to be, you know, caught, if you like. And so that exaggerates the risk of fire use. And so there's this pressure that comes from the policy context, from this prohibitive, increasingly prohibited fire use. And these families too, though, are the ones who incur the burden. When the forest around them burns, that will include their Swinburne plots. And there's very limited capacity to try to fight fires or organisation for services to reach these areas and to assist in dousing fires. So, you know, it's this situation which I think raises very serious dilemmas around justice and equity, because whilst the landscape is becoming more flammable, these families also have, you know, least to do with that. And then, of course, you know, similar to climate justice, there is the problem of the fact that being on the front line of the burden whilst contributing least to the problem. And one thing which I've, another thing I should say really, which I've noticed about this context is also how I think, and I haven't studied it though, I would like to get together a project on that, how the discourse of fire, tropical fire, is usually around the carbon and the biodiversity implications, and very, very scarce do we hear about the lived dimension of tropical fire. But we showed, you know, there are material burdens, there are relational burdens too, and subjective, if we think about well-being, for instance, material, relational, subjective dimensions of well-being. Tropical fire and extensive fires in these landscapes really has implications for all those dimensions of well-being borne on the shoulders of small-scale farmers. So it's interesting to me that that narrative is missing from the discourse of fire. And if we, I mean, certainly the footage of Australia's fires or the fires in the US, it's often about how many people are being evacuated, how many people have had to leave their homes. It's a very different sort of story. So I think this might be the final slide. Oh, no, not quite. This is sort of summarizing, I suppose, some of what I was just talking about. Conflating fire types is a big issue, and I think contributes to this one size fits all type of prohibitive policy, which has justice dilemmas associated with it, as well as perverse outcomes which can accrue. In fact, there are all of these different place-based burdens of landscape flammability which are being overlooked. And the leading discourses around carbon and biodiversity rather than the lived experience or this humanitarian dimension, which is potentially more powerful in terms of thinking about languages that can contribute towards change, because maybe the narrative of human burdens is more compelling and harder for governments to denounce or at least deflect, because the carbon, you know, carbon narrative encounters then all sorts of responses related to rights to develop, etc., and oil palm is generating GDP. So there's also the argument that it's worth it, if you like. And I think at the backdrop is the fact that this context of one nefarious fire and carbon environmental burdens of fire, backwards smallholder practices, and that framing all contributes towards legitimizing these prohibitive policies, which are actually extenuating already existing vulnerabilities, and in some instances then contributing to, for example, the global land grab. So how could things be better? Well, in fact, I wasn't going to talk about this that much, but then I noticed that the title that you'd given my talk in the latest email. So I added this slide in, and maybe, you know, there's some traction in co-creating alternatives, adaptive responses to the reality that landscapes really are more flammable. So while smallholder agriculture is longstanding, there is a need for adaptations, because the risks of fires escaping has changed over time. And whilst the fault of that is perhaps a separate issue, the reality is smallholders probably do need adaptation measures to reduce the risk of fire escape. Central to responses, I think, is the recognition of these distinct fire types. And again, you know, targeted policy, one size doesn't fit all. I'm interested in the traction of shifting the discourse, and a lot of my work is trying to contribute to that, from this, the carbon and the environmental, to also forefronting the human dimension. And I suppose ultimately a need to reconcile global discourse with the lived local reality for more equitable interventions. And those were some thoughts, and happy to go into any of that in more detail. That's really just to start us off, I suppose. And it's nice to know that there are other fiery folk in the in the room. So thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. That's great. And it's really interesting that actually you focus on smallholder farmers, because somehow to me fires are actually associated with big companies rather than smallholder farmers. So I would point the fingers at the big food production companies. But I wanted to ask you one question before we start with everyone else. Have you looked at the balances in terms of legal ownership of the land, and how does that shift, and does that have an impact on the type of views, and you know, does it differ in Brazil and in Indonesia?
Well, I looked at tenure in a number of ways, looking at, for example, fire frequency inside different types of protected areas and sustainable use reserves. Did a study to see whether or not the introduction of that policy change, the change in land tenure, influenced fire frequency or fire management, and found that no, it didn't, apart from in the sustainable use reserves, when actually it seemed that in fact fires increased. Perhaps we didn't, you know, in terms of understanding why, we were hypothesizing that could be related to people in the landscape becoming aware that the reserve is going to be rolled out and therefore burning, you know, to make claims before that happened. But land tenure is a really big problem. For example, in Indonesia, where I worked, we looked at, we did a study evaluating a fire-free village, which was it's a PES program, so Payment for Environmental Service program, which is actually run by April, which is a pulp and paper company, big pulp and paper company. And this fire-free village program is advertised as being conditional cash reward. So if there's no fire in the landscape, communities get quite a heavy financial reward. And the company, of course, benefits because its plantations are protected from invading fires. And it's a standardized approach. So it has five different sets of activities in this model, in the fire-free village model. And one of those activities is helping small-scale farmers to bring their land into production without fire. So the company offers their machinery to help to clear the land. And when I heard about that, I thought, well, that's the key, because if there's an alternative, you know, then that's all, that's going to work. Mm-hmm. But actually what happened is the company couldn't really utilize that part of the program as much as it had planned to, because so many different smallholders didn't actually have the title to show for their land. And so the company was nervous about helping to clear land, which the tenure was, you know, not clear for, and so couldn't do that part of the support which they'd intended to do. And so it's just one way in which tenure, the absence of clear tenure, complicates the problem. But there are many other ways, and even when tenure is clear, it's still a bit of a leap of faith to then make the link that the whoever is on paper owning that land is definitely the one who set the fire.
Right.
There are, you know, fires for sabotage. There are paper parks, obviously, and actually different people in those parks, or land tenure ascribed to one landowner, but actually in practice, you know, the difference between de jure and de facto is quite extreme in some cases. So tenure is a key problem.
That's interesting. Anyone else have comments or questions? And I'd like to ask you another question, but I'll wait.
Rachel, that was fascinating. I really enjoyed it. And I thought your framing, I mean, I work on fire more from a carbon standpoint, but very much trying to find ways to implement fire to conserve carbon, and like this whole perception of fire is good. And anyways, I'm wondering if you have any idea about similar perspectives in rangelands in these tropical environments. Like a lot of my work is in sub-Saharan Africa, And there, you know, the perception of fire is very different in the areas dominated by savanna and rangeland. And have you, you know, do some of these countries differentiate in their governance? I mean, I know Brazil had that blanket no fire policy, but in like African countries, I was looking at some of them, like Gabon and Cameroon, Tanzania, like they burn the Serengeti, right? That's natural management. I don't know, I'm kind of rambling, but basically how do they differentiate like Sweden from more maybe traditional or necessary rangeland burning?
Well, I mean, in the context of Africa, I'm really not as familiar with, but I know that in Brazil, for example, on the Cerrado, the savannas there, there are different sorts of initiatives happening now because, you know, the land and the ecology has a different relationship with fire. And actually, you can use fire probably similar to how you might in parts of the, some of the areas that you're talking about, you know, and how in some parts of the US they do it too, but to manage fire with fire. Mm-hmm. And so indigenous communities in the Cerrado have been doing that over in the past. But then there was a period of time when that type of fire management was prohibited. And so all fire use was, you know, was basically heavily discouraged. But now after large scale fires in the Cerrado, there's more work to try to, between the government institutions and traditional land managers, to have a more integrated fire management. So to try to involve and include some indigenous ways of land management and burning the land. And I know that's happening also in Australia, making quite some progress in terms of linking, I guess, science, expert knowledge and local place-based. Very, I've got a fire burning in my eyes, actually. So yes, I think there is some distinction between maybe in terms of, at least in Brazil, different in the savannah compared with the north in the Amazon. And maybe though there are times, you know, like there was the total burn ban, but I think that was an exceptional year. And in Indonesia, also burn bans have been in place. I think Indonesia doesn't do so well in targeting different types of fire management response because there they've got, you know, they've got such a problem on the peatlands versus mineral soils, but often they get conflated together and it's all treated as one when really the distinctions are huge between fire management on peat versus mineral soil.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rachel. Anyone else?
Rachel, first, can I apologise? I have to leave in about 10 minutes, but I really enjoyed your talk.
Oh, thank you.
But before that, I should say I'm an archaeologist, and of the various regions, the one I'm most familiar with is Southeast Asia, where the Sweden agriculture is very much linked to ethnic minorities and ethnic minorities that maybe cross national boundaries, say between China and Burma or something like that. And certainly in Southeast Asia, that the relationship between those ethnic minorities who've been forced into the montane border regions and the lowland dominated legal framework is, shall I say, complicated. And and the constitution and legal framework is, one might say, is weighted towards the lowland farming by the ethnic majority and so forth. And so empowering ethnic minorities at an international level is part of the process to do anything, but nonetheless very difficult. I mean, is that issue of ethnic dimension between Sweden agriculture and lowland agriculture is prevalent through your work?
Well, sorry, in fact, there was an email that came through when you asked me the last question, but I was just going, so it got my eye because it popped up down there. But in terms of empowering local communities and, you know, trying to give better voice to these different realities. I think that that is sort of happening to some extent. At least, you know, I think Brazil is very distinct from Indonesia. And so I'm curious to know more about the places you spoke about. In Indonesia, really, the minority groups are so invisible.
Right.
And the contrast with Brazil, I think, probably makes it more apparent because, you know, Brazil, there's a lot of organization and a real clamoring that comes from those groups. And they're supported by some brilliant and well-known NGOs, which in Indonesia, there's really just a man who supports, you know, the indigenous groups. And it's the story or what you hear most about and the research seems to be more smallholders, you know, sort of all grouped together in a way. And other types of ethnicities, but not the really small scale existing or kind of persisting groups like the Talang Mamak and the Orang Rimba, who are so few and really dispersed and have really no claim to, well, I don't mean they have no claim, they should have, but no recognized claim to their lands and are being moved on all the time by the extensive spread of oil palm and agriculture. But then, yeah, and I think that there's such a strong link between fire and food sovereignty. And so I think lots of the different peasant movements, you know, coming together to keep their access to seeds, to keep their access to land. Fire is obviously central, you know, part of all of that as well, part of all of that endeavor, because without fire, at the moment at least, I mean, of course, things are likely to change, aren't they? And I think there probably is some need for change because landscapes are becoming more flammable. But anyway, I've rambled a response to you, sorry.
And Richard, did you find then this, you know, you've been comparing now, answering to Martin, Brazil and Indonesia. How about then sub-Saharan Africa, as Adam was mentioning? Is that?
No, I don't know. Or maybe, yeah. Adam, I'm really not very familiar at all with.
So maybe that's your next area, Rachel. You have a new focus. So you can enlarge your travelling geography as well.
Yeah, I don't know about, I was thinking more about scaling that back. And fire on the UK's peatlands, I thought, is also a contested issue, actually. Yeah. Just been doing a very small sort of collaboration with a woman out of Exeter, looking at different perceptions of fire and peatland management in Yorkshire. And it's interesting how polarised that is, actually, you know, that these sort of fire is a beast, no matter where. Yeah.
Mm. You should talk to David Coombs. He's really into peatlands at the moment.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you find that common element. Did you find it difficult to talk to the different groups when, you know, from a confidential point of view? And it must, you know, obviously it's very political. So how did you kind of go along and who did you work with in a way?
Yeah, well, we tried to, in Indonesia, again, it's sort of very distinct from Brazil, I would say. And in Brazil, people are quite open and happy to share and to complain as well as celebrate. So I think and I was there for a long time living in the communities. So I think I had a good relationship, but and also that's easier to obtain somehow in Brazil. So I wasn't too worried about that there. But in Indonesia, it's quite different. I don't know if any of you know Indonesia, and maybe Martin will. I hope I'm not going to say anything that's unacceptable.
No, I don't, but I work more in the mainland, so you say what you like about Indonesia. Oh, right. I've only gone there as a tourist, so.
Oh, okay. Well, it's, you know, there's a hierarchy that exists, and as a foreigner, you are always you have to use the formal language, and people will always speak to you with the formal language. So I think there's an immediate distance, which I found extremely hard to overcome. And so I did worry about that, getting people speaking to people about things which are sensitive. And also people don't really like generally, especially in Java. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that is distinct a bit to the communities where we worked in some, but still there's it was difficult to have, I think, an open communication. And because in recognition of that, we used different methods, and we used a method called Q method, which actually is more of it's more like a game in the way in which data is collected, in the sense that participants don't need to speak to you necessarily, or they don't need to open up about sensitive issues, because they instead read statements and then place statements on a scale of agreement or disagreement, or importance or not importance. And so we hoped, through using that method, which Bhaskar and colleagues had used before as well, and we hoped that using that method would help us to sort of go into this space that was a bit more sensitive.
Do you think it helped?
Yeah, I think it did help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I know I've never worked in Dayak communities in Indonesia, but apparently that's very different, and people will speak more freely again then. But the community, yeah.
Yeah.
So there, you do have to consider those things, I think, when you're
doing
your work, and then reflect on them later as well when you have the data.
I guess there's also a degree of mistrust. And concern that whatever they say might be perhaps misconstructed and misrepresented.
Yeah, and with the Fire Free Village work, for example, there was always a worry that people would associate us then with the programme. And the programme was private sector programme, and had also been introduced as with army officials there on the days when it was being introduced. So actually community members were a bit confused. Was it a private sector, or was it a government thing, or was it a combination of both? And because we were studying that, we always tried to make it really clear that we weren't part of it, but we were, you know, independent. And actually there were Indonesian students from the region who were heavily involved in collecting data. So I think that helped.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Rachel, I'm curious. So I actually have a PhD student working in Scotland, and deep peat, deep mineral soil. And one thing that struck me when I was up there was I was working on lands that were run by the Forest Service, Scottish Forest Service, lands that were run by a conservation organization and then private shareholder. And what struck me was how politicized the scientific management of the conservation organizations was. You know, they were adjusting their fire management because of how it would be perceived.
Mm.
And that was a huge eye opener to me, because I thought, shouldn't the focus be on conserving biodiversity and these fire adapted landscapes? And so that's when I saw your talk, I was also really interested in that, because it almost seems like in some regions that conservation organizations, because of how they survive, is at odds with their goal. And I didn't want to say that out loud, you know, don't quote me, but as a result
it's being recorded.
I won't spread it too far and wide.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna get my permits yanked, but as a result of that, the prescribed burning component of one of the projects was canceled. And I don't know, I'd be really curious to follow your work on in that space.
Well, I mean, I think that's a broader issue. I mean, just this morning we had a guest lecture from Moira Moliono at C4, she came and spoke to master's students that we have on climate change and international development, and she was talking about, you know, all of those types of dilemmas, but she was talking in the context of REDD+ in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the difficulty of of reconciling competing differences between stakeholders. And is there ever a solution that everybody is going to be satisfied with? And then if not, what's an appropriate trade-off? And, you know, these are just such sort of big problems, I suppose, so complex. But then maybe on a hopeful note, could you hope that through making that sort of acquiescing slightly, perhaps then improving a relationship with those stakeholders, and in a couple of years, getting more fire management in there? Yeah, I don't have any answer to that. But even last week also, I was at the COP, and there was the Peatlands Pavilion. So this year, through the GPI, which is the Global Peatlands Initiative, there was a peat pavilion at COP. And I organized a session there, and, you know, was around for others. And it was interesting how even in peat institutions, for example, the International Peatland Society are very polemic in terms of what they think is appropriate for peatland management versus some of the UN organizations, for example. And there's a great big dispute about is it possible to extract sustainably on peat or not? And things that you would think, you know, that's such a fundamental bottom line, but yet there were people actually on other sides of the bench.
But I think it's just to fit your argument to justify then your actions, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. On the Peatland Society thing, there were some business representatives who basically entire livelihoods and income streams depend on peat extraction. Of course, they would prefer possible to do
the sustainability of the extraction.
Do you think there's a way to map the distribution of Swidden agriculture used for small shareholder agriculture or small shareholder farms rather than like large corporation, you know, slash and burning in the true sense, to try to inform some of these things? You know, when we estimate carbon emissions, for example, at the global scale, it's at like quarter degree resolution, and you don't know where the carbon is coming from with the fire and whether or not it's a fire that people literally need to maintain their fields or it's a fire because there's an oil palm plantation. You know, and those that has really big, really important implications for things like targeting carbon credit schemes.
I've been wondering that too. I think that would be such a useful piece of information to have as well, because there are so many different competing interests and people, there's a blame game that's, you know, happening. In Indonesia, the small scale farmers blame the companies and they blame the small scale farmers. And then scientists come in and say, hang on, this is a false dichotomy. There's all these medium scale enterprises in the middle. who's contributing what to fire escape would be a really interesting thing to know. Apart from, I guess it's a bit more complex than that because the contribution to fire escape is also because of landscape flammability, and that's the fault of, climate change. The fragmentation of the landscapes also has a role to play. But I suppose you could have a simple analysis of where you could look at fire progression and see from where do fires start and what those fires are escaping into forests. I think then the problem is identifying fires under the canopy is still really hard. And those are the instances of fire escape that you would want to know about.
That is very interesting, because we were thinking about using, like, for a few countries where there's high resolution data on commodity production, identifying commodities that are tightly linked with like small shareholder Sweden.
Yeah.
And then doing just some super coarse, like burned area weighted by commodity.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that would be really nice. In fact, I was speaking with David Gaveau about something similar because he has, you know, the New Centara Atlas, where you can see deforestation inside different tenure types. So you can see which plantations and concessions to deforestation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then we did put together some ideas for this, looking at fire in that as well as just deforestation, but then trying to link the flow, because of course it's not enough to say that since fire and deforestation are happening in that landscape, culpability lies only there. Mm-hmm. The markets which are demanding the produce must have a role. Mm-hmm. Then you could link the flow data to see what production is, what markets and where, and then think about culpability, you know, thinking about actually transboundary governance and the role of actors across scales in the fire dynamic.
Almost like a state responsibility, really.
Yeah, or responsibility across scales.
Yeah. That would be interesting. Probably quite hard to apply, but definitely.
Well, there's work happening on material flows, really amazing work. Yeah. Looking at like Manfred Lenzen stuff, mapping the material flows of nations and then showing how nations have and their consumption is related to biodiversity losses in faraway landscapes. So you could do something similar, I think. Would be really
Rachel, maybe you can leave Adam your email address and see if you want.
Yes, sure.
Yeah. Message, especially given that you have this PhD student, Adam, you can connect.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, they're very.
I'll send an email. Actually, I'll put you in touch. So
thank you, Fran. Cool.
Great. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Well, thanks. You know, unfortunately,
several people have dropped out because obviously it's getting towards.
Getting prepared for the next.
But it's been really, really interesting, and glad that you found. Did you find COP useful or interesting? And
that's definitely interesting.
Give hopes. Yeah,
I didn't find it very hopeful. I found the most hopeful thing really on the streets. I mean, the energy, the people,
did
something different, felt quite something. But inside, I was a bit disheartened. All of the talk about finance to these communities, planting trees to offset, just didn't really.
Yeah.
The transformation that's
adapt.
Anyway,
we'll see. We'll probably talk about this again in COP35 or whatever. If we get there before we melt it all, anyway. But on this positive note,
have a good weekend, everybody.
Thank you so much, Rachel, and I'll send that email.
Okay,
great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Bye. Bye.